Bona tarda a tothom. Benvinguts a aquesta nova edició dels debats d'educació. Tornem a ser aquí, de fet, pocs dies després del darrer debat, que ho faríem fa solament dues setmanes en aquesta mateixa sala. En aquest cas, per explorar des de l'enfocament de la neurociència i de la mà del professor Howard Jones, com podem jugar, aprendre i ser creatius. Aquest va ser el nostre darrer debat. Avui, novament, hem de començar expressant el nostre agraïment per tots els que ens acompanyeu en aquest auditori magnífic, de què podem gaudir perquè el MACBA col·labora en aquesta iniciativa i ens ofereix el seu suport per enregistrar l'acte, la qual cosa ens permet posar a la vostra disposició tot el material que es desprèn de cadascun dels debats en la web d'aquesta iniciativa. Que la teniu aquí al darrere, impressionada. A banda de les persones que us heu desplaçat fins aquí, també hem d'agrair l'atenció i la participació del nombre, hem de dir, cada vegada més gran de persones que ens aneu seguint a través de video streaming i que també participeu activament en la discussió enviant els vostres suggeriments i les vostres preguntes a través de la xarxa. Us animem doncs avui també a ser-hi presents i per tant doncs moltes gràcies a tots una vegada més. Debats d'educació és una iniciativa de la Fundació Jaume Bofill i dels Estudis de Psicologia i Ciències de l'Educació de la Universitat Oberta de Catalunya. Aquest és un espai de debat obert, ara ja fa més de 10 anys, que en un dia com avui, amb el tema que hem de tractar, hem de dir que és possible per la cooperació sostinguda d'aquestes dues institucions entestades a oferir una opció per la participació de la ciutadania en general i de la comunitat educativa, molt particularment en el seu sentit extens. Debats d'educació és un espai que vol servir també per la sensibilització dels principals actors socioeconòmics, polítics, de la cultura del nostre país, en la discussió de les qüestions que considerem més crítiques que afecten l'educació d'avui, per tant, doncs, fem atenció als temes d'actualitat, però també amb la mirada sempre posada en els reptes de fons que ens depara el futur. Amb aquesta vocació, Debats d'Educació incorpora la perspectiva d'experts del nostre context immediat, però també manté l'ambició d'apropar el contrast que podem obtenir d'altres òptiques i experiències provenents del context internacional. Aquesta és, novament, la intenció d'avui. Pretenem aturar-nos avui en el tema de l'aprenentatge cooperatiu, una de les aproximacions a què concedim major potencialitat a l'hora de tractar els processos d'ensenyament i aprenentatge, no volem perdre de vista allò que ja fa temps que sabem, que és la naturalesa marcadament social d'aquests processos. La nostra convidada, la professora Nancy Madden, ens oferirà una nova mirada sobre la potencialitat d'aquesta manera d'entendre l'aprenentatge, però abans de donar-li la paraula, serà en Baltasar Méndez, cap de projectes internacionals de la Fundació Jaume Bofill, qui us presentarà la nostra ponent i el tema que abordarà.
Moltes gràcies, José María. Gràcies a tothom per ser aquí amb nosaltres. I thank you very much, Nancy, especially for you. Tenim el plaer de comptar amb Nancy Madden avui. Val? Ella és professora del Center for Research and Reform in Education, que, com sabeu, està a la Johns Hopkins University als Estats Units. També col·labora a l'Institut for Effective Education, que està a la Universitat de York, al Regne Unit, i és presidenta i cofundadora d'una institució molt rellevant per nosaltres que es diu Success for All, que podríem traduir com èxit per a tothom. Doncs en aquesta institució hi treballen 200 persones que creuen, bueno, que estan creant, perdó, i difonent programes educatius que estan basats en l'evidència, que han estat garantits per la recerca, que han estat validats com programes efectius. I no només això, treballen especialment en zones desafavorides, en entorns, amb nens i nenes amb dificultats. Val? Ens parlarà d'això. Però la doctora Madden va començar, diguem-ne, es va graduar en 1973 en una facultat d'educació americana, que és el Reed College, que coneixeu, és una universitat d'arts liberals molt prestigiosa, per allà va passar Steve Jobs, encara que no es va quedar molt de temps, i la doctora Madden sí es va quedar.
That's right.
It's true, isn't it? Ella sí es va quedar, però tot sortint d'allà se'n va anar a l'American University, es va poder fer, doctorar en psicologia clínica. És autora de molts llibres, molts informes sobre el tema que es ocupa aquí, avui aquí, que és el tema de l'aprenentatge cooperatiu, però tot això ho podeu trobar a internet, val? No llegiré el seu extens currículum, no és això. I sí, vull compartir amb vosaltres el per què ens ha motivat molt poder comptar amb la professora Nancy aquí avui. Doncs ens ha motivat la seva passió, la passió que té per transformar el món de l'educació, i l'evidència en què es basa i la pràctica que té en el dia a dia. Diguem-ne que ella, juntament amb el seu marit, que tenim el plaer de tenir amb nosaltres aquí, el doctor Robert, que està aquí davant, thank you very much for being here, ells dos han creat aquesta organització, Success for All, que estan treballant allà, on the ground, no? en el dia a dia, amb els nens i nenes, i podem dir que han estat responsables per un canvi educatiu en aquestes escoles amb les quals ells estan vinculats, amb bàsicament uns 2 milions de nens i nenes. Val? Estem parlant d'un aprenentatge cooperatiu aplicat a la pràctica, basat en evidència, amb un impacte real. I per això els convidem avui, i especialment la doctora Nancy, per compartir els seus secrets. Perquè sabem, a Catalunya hem treballat molt el tema d'aprenentatge cooperatiu, tenim experiències fantàstiques, la Universitat de Vic, diferents persones que han treballat, institucions, però encara costa que aquest aprenentatge cooperatiu sigui massiu. No? Podem dir que encara ens falta una mica. I volem convidar la doctora Nancy a compartir amb nosaltres quin és el seu secret, com és que han aconseguit portar aquest aprenentatge i tenir èxit en aquestes zones desafavorides i a prop de 2 milions de nens. Amb aquest petit repte, convidem la doctora a començar la seva xerrada. Thank you very much, Nancy. You have the floor.
Thank you very much. It's been... thank you. I can take this off now. No, I didn't take the other one off. All right. It is a pleasure to be here to talk to you all today. We have Jaume Beaufil, if I can get that correct, as it's been a delightful couple of days getting to understand something about the Catalan culture and issues in education here it's just a pleasure. Everyone keeps apologizing, saying they've been keeping us busy in talks, but that makes it fun and very entertaining and very educational for us to be here as well. So, I will say us because my husband, Robert Slavin, is here as well and has been speaking and is my partner in the work that we have done over many years. We actually began to work together at Reed College, where this was before Steve Jobs came. And as you say, we stayed and finished. But we were working to become teachers when we were at Reed College, and were concerned at that time about the number of students who were just sort of written off. They were not successful and not really expected to be successful in school. And we noticed that these same children could learn every score of their favorite baseball team and rattle off the ratings and the statistics. And it wasn't that they weren't able to learn, it was that they weren't engaged in school. And we wanted to bring the excitement of the sports team and the support of the sports team to these students so that they could be successful in this very important part of their lives in learning as well as with their peers in sports. So we began to play with cooperative learning structures at that time. And we knew we had to bring team celebrations into the classroom. So that was one of the key elements that we brought in first. So we asked kids to work together in teams, and we got them interested in working in teams by saying, if you all do a good job of learning, then your team will be successful. So in the typical classroom, what was happening was that the teacher would pose a question. The students who knew the answer would raise their hand. The other students who didn't know the answer would hide. Very few students were actively engaged, and those students who knew the answer weren't interested in the students that didn't, that they weren't asked to be interested. And those students who didn't know the answer knew that they really didn't have a chance, so they might as well, you know, just stay quiet and not really be engaged. So in bringing teams into the classroom, we were changing that entirely so that those kids that did know something had a responsibility to engage their teammates and make sure they did learn. And those who had a chance to engage and explain and talk suddenly found out that they really did know a lot because they could share it with their teammates. So we began to play with this idea, then went on to teach for a while and then to do research at Johns Hopkins. We went all the way from one side of the United States to the other. And the United States is big. It's not like Europe, which is tiny. So we came to Johns Hopkins and did a lot of research because we found that while cooperative learning is very quickly able to break down a lot of barriers in the classroom and create very positive social interactions in the classroom and create engagement, it doesn't always result in increased learning. And we wanted all of the social benefits of cooperative learning, but we also wanted to increase the actual learning of all students in the classroom. Again, our initial concern was that some students were not able to reach their potential. They were not learning what they could do, even though we knew they could. So we not only wanted the positive social results, we wanted increased learning for students. So as we did the research, we found out that there were a couple of critical elements to ensuring that learning occurred. One was that all students had to demonstrate their learning individually. We call it individual accountability. That learning could be demonstrated through a typical assessment where teacher would give an assignment and would score that assignment. And then the team's results on those assignments would be added together and the celebration done for teams that did a good job. It could be on a piece of writing that students would write. It could be on a set of oral responses that students would give. So there are a wide range of ways to assess the individual learning of students. But it was critical that the individual learning be assessed. Many folks who support cooperative learning work sometimes by just providing a product that the group does together. When our children were in school, many times their teachers would put them in groups where the product of the group was perhaps a report or perhaps a diorama. Is that an English word? I mean, is that a Catalan word? Or a product. But oftentimes, in our kids' experience, one child in the group completed that product rather than all children contributing and learning. So we don't consider that the kind of cooperative learning that will work, or it's not a matter of not considering that. We've done the research that demonstrates that that kind of group work does not result in increased learning for students, because it's not necessary for all students to demonstrate their learning. So that was one of the elements that we knew, we determined through the research, that was necessary for students to learn more in a cooperative learning structure. We also determined in our research that students needed to have team feedback. We sometimes call that a team reward, but it's not really necessary that that teams be rewarded, but it's necessary that teams get feedback on the success of their work. It's not enough that kids simply do work together. It's fun. It's better than just inactively sitting and listening to a teacher. But if there isn't feedback, there isn't the motivation to make sure that every member of the team is actually engaged and is working. So picture a classroom where, let's say it's a math classroom, where kids are 10-year-olds are working on learning how to do problems with fractions. Do you still teach fractions around here, or just decimals? Fractions? Yeah. So students are learning something that's a little complex and, you know, something that's challenging to them. It's hard for another student to say, you didn't get that right. You need to work on that harder. But if they're in a team where their team success depends on the fact that every child in that group actually learns the material, because they're going to have to demonstrate that learning each individually, then that gives kids permission to say, no, you have to work harder on that. You can't just let that go. You can't just accept that you can't learn that. You actually have to learn that. You have to master that. So that it gives kids permission to really demand from each other more effort and more work. And they get greater satisfaction for doing it. But if there isn't that team feedback frequently, there isn't that motivation to ensure that everybody is doing their best and working hard. So I've gone well beyond how did we get started here. One of the things that we note, and you know, I'll ask you, how many of you are teachers in the audience? Many of you are teachers. Most of you are teachers. In your experience, in your schools, is there cooperative learning used? Is that something that's common in your schools? Raise your hand if you see that commonly in your schools. Often often in the United States, and perhaps not here, and I will hopefully hear more about that as you ask your questions. Often in the U.S., we see what is called, what we would call group work, but not what Bob and I would call true cooperative learning. Because if the interdependence, if true positive interdependence is not there, then again, the group doesn't have the motivation to ensure that all members of the team are working. So we make a distinction between group work and cooperative learning, with the distinction being that positive interdependence, that students must all succeed in a group in order for the group to succeed, that's the hallmark of true cooperative learning. So, you know, I've talked about the motivation that goes into true cooperative learning. When we celebrate team success, we often celebrate it with very simple things like an announcement of the success of the team to the class. We've developed ways of ensuring that not just one team can be successful, because that limits the amount of celebration that can occur. But for instance, if any team that is successful, any team that achieves a score of 90% on an assessment or an essay or an activity is judged to be successful, then all teams that can achieve that level can be successful. And if the team achieves an 80, maybe they're a great team as opposed to a super team. Very simple ways of sort of describing to a team their level of success. These have been very powerful in our work with schools. I'm thinking of a middle school right now. In the U.S., a middle school would be children who are 12, 13 years old. We had a project going on again in math in this school. And in one classroom, what the most exciting thing that they could get if they succeeded as a team was to sit on these little yoga balls. So they had a set of yoga balls in the classroom, and that was the success. Teachers find all kinds of ways of describing to kids what their success is. Another class had a stuffed animal, and you know, teams that did a great job got to have that stuffed animal sitting on their tables for the week. You know, it's more the communication of success and the acknowledgement that the result of their work has been significant learning that is the critical feedback for teams. So that's what turns the dynamic from students worrying about their own success to having them be concerned and work hard for the success of their team. So one of the critical things that occurs in effective cooperative learning is that students are giving each other explanations about their thinking and are not only hearing the explanations that other students are giving, but giving explanations, articulating their ideas, and having to find the gaps in their understanding and the gaps in their articulation, and really rehearsing what it is that they are working on learning. This process of both speaking and listening engages the synthesis that students have to do in order to process and own the learning that they're working on. It's the part that makes it go from passive to active. Now, I was thinking of doing a little simulation to make you all engaged, but I understand we have folks streaming out there, and I'm thinking that maybe we'll skip this. But imagine in your mind that I asked you to do this. I was going to require you to actually chat with three people next to you and share with each other your reason for coming today, and then synthesize among the four of you what it was about your reasons that was common. So the reason I selected that task is I wanted you actually to not just report, but to think and to come to a joint understanding. And then I was going to require you to all be prepared to report for your team. So one of the techniques that we've learned, that we've developed as a part of our work in cooperative learning is called Random Reporter. And I was going to make you all have the opportunity to be chosen as the Random Reporter. That means that I was going to ask you to number off 1 through 4 and then randomly ask one of you to be the reporter for your team. That is to say, I wasn't going to ask anyone to raise their hand. I wasn't going to let you choose for yourselves who was going to be the reporter. I was going to choose one of you randomly to be responsible for reporting for your team. And that's the dynamic that we want to have going in the team. We want the team to be ensuring that each member of the team is ready to report on their learning, has actually learned it. And again, that takes it from a situation where I know that I learned it and I'm done, my responsibility in learning is done. Well, my responsibility in learning wouldn't be done until all members of my team understood the learning and was prepared to share their learning for the benefit of the team. So again, we call that little trick Random Reporter, and it works incredibly well. If we have time, I'll share with you another part of that trick, which is developing a rubric to ensure that the quality of answers that kids give are very high. And that's the next level of trick that we have with Random Reporter. In our form of cooperative learning, we use four-person teams because 4 is a nice number. It's not too small and not too large. And that's about the level of sophistication we have with choosing the size of the group. Since class size is not always divisible by 4, we will have teams of 5 if there are extra students, and teams of 5 work well as well. And that allows students to have to work as pairs, to work as 2 pairs, or to have discussions that are rich and engaging with still giving children a chance to be fully engaged and to talk. We have in our structure, children aren't always coming to school ready to cooperate. It's something they often have to be taught how to do. So, and yet we don't want to spend all of our time teaching cooperation. We've got a lot of stuff we need kids to learn and to know. So we've developed some very simple, a simple mantra, the poster on the wall that is in every classroom that talks about what are the key skills involved in being a good member of a team, in working well as a member of a cooperative team. We teach kids active listening, which means we teach them to how to give eye contact, how to sit facing a speaker, how to acknowledge that they're listening with nods or yeses or restating what their partner has said or what their teammate has said. It's interesting how difficult it is to teach active listening, but it's something that is important for kids to be successful. We teach kids how to explain their ideas, what that means, and that telling why. It's not just you never give an answer. You have to explain that answer and elaborate it. We teach them that it's their job to ensure that everyone participates, that they need to encourage their teammates, and that they need to complete their work. They need to stay on task and not wander off talking about their favorite sports team. So we talked about some of the products that that students might use as the basis for celebration and Random Reporter. Let me tell you one other great trick, by the way, to ensure that students are engaged even when the explanations are going on. Do you all know the term think, pair, share? Is that something that's familiar? No? This is just a way to quickly engage children to talk And again, my goal is to never have a teacher ask a question and have children raise their hands. And this is hard to stamp out, let me tell you. It's very hard. But we try by teaching teachers that if they ask a question, they provide children with time to think. And then they ask them to pair, which is to speak to a partner and articulate their thinking, to speak it out loud and in a sentence, and then to share. And then that's when a partnership would share the thinking that they have been talking about. So these tools can engage teachers who are just learning how to engage children in cooperative activities to become more engaged and more active. So we use techniques like this to get teachers going. I wanted to share with you some comments from kids. And I'll read this one to you because it's in English. It says, I love how we are doing maths. I used to be rubbish at maths. Now I'm really good and I'm more confident of what I'm doing. So I like it. I love how we do our work with Team Mastery and Random Reporter. So they're actually talking about the techniques that they've been doing. And the attitude is different. And this is from another student. Says this, I'm not sure I can even read that. This team thing, right, has been good because we've been explaining the, can you read that one? Explaining it. And I like that we do active listening. So these from the teachers are more readable. The program has raised my expectations of what the children can do, and it's also raised the students' own expectations of themselves. And another teacher said, my class is much more engaged in math lessons, and the children are enjoying talking about math. So again, the attitudes change, the feeling is different, and it can be a very quick transition. So let me qualify that a little bit. So in this particular study that we actually did in England, and you can tell that because the teachers and students all say maths instead of math. This was a study where we invited schools to participate. And usually when we invite schools to participate, we ask them to take a vote about whether they'd like to change the way they teach. And we tell them about what the process would be. In the case of studies, it rarely happens so neatly because you have to randomize for studies. So teachers were never quite sure what they were getting into. But these teachers were given a training session and given materials that were built to do cooperative learning so that they were team practice activities and were provided with coaching. And within a couple of months, were doing an effective implementation of cooperative learning. So my point is that teachers can be successful at very large changes in the way they teach in a fairly short period of time if they are given effective supports for changing. We learned how to work with teachers by listening to what teachers had to say to us. When we started out, when we'd done our first research in cooperative learning, and we're going back to the 1980s now. We're very old. When we started working with teachers, we had this great knowledge from the research that we'd done, and we wanted to share it. We didn't want to just do research and publish it in nice journals and have nice academic lives. We really did it to make a difference. And so we started having workshops for teachers, and we invited teachers to come to Baltimore, and which is where Johns Hopkins is, which is why I keep talking about Baltimore. They came for wonderful three-day workshops and had great fun and were all excited and went back to teach in their classrooms. And when we checked with them a few months later, they would say, well, we really wanted to do it. It was a great idea. We really, really believe in it, but we just couldn't figure it out. It was too hard. So we said, well, what would help you? What would help you do it? And they said, well, you know, we have to make all these team practice materials. And so we said, okay, we'll make team practice materials and we'll just give it to you. So we began to make the materials that they asked for to make team practice easier and assessments to do the individual assessment of student learning. That's what teachers asked us to do, and we did that. So then we gave workshops and we provided materials. And still, when we asked teachers, how are you doing with this cooperative learning thing, which they'd been very excited about at the workshops, they said, well, we tried, but the other teachers in the school, they said that it was too noisy, so we gave up. Or they said, most of my kids really liked it, but I had one kid that really couldn't get along with his team, so we gave up. And so we figured out that there was something else that was needed. Besides a great idea and passion, there was a lot of skill that was needed as well. So we began providing coaching for teachers. And that coaching would entail going to their school and watching them teach and giving them feedback or talking with them and helping them, having them present their problems, or engaging teachers in cooperative groups in their schools and enabling them to have opportunities to problem solve with each other with the support of experienced coaches. And those things made a lot of difference. We began to see teachers who could sustain a good implementation of cooperative learning as their standard way of approaching instruction. And that was very exciting. And we began to move from that into school-wide support of cooperative learning, because if one teacher in a school is working with such a different way of teaching, there's peer pressure to give it up and to do things in a more standard way. And we found that to really sustain a change in an instructional process, it was much more effective to have the school-wide collaboration in support of that change and that innovation. So that was something that became very important to sustain the changes that cooperative learning required. So I wanted to tell you a little bit at this point about the work that we got into as our work became more mature. As we did this research and as we published some articles and things like that, we had the folks from the school district in Baltimore come to us and say, you know, you all in your ivory tower at Johns Hopkins, you know so much. We have students who are failing all the time. At that time, which was, you know, still back in the 80s, 50% of Baltimore City's students did not succeed in graduating from high school. Half the students in the city didn't graduate, and they dropped out. They just gave up because they saw no chance of actually being successful in school. So the school district came to us and said, you know, we want to work with you to create success for kids. They said, if you had everything you needed and could ensure that students were successful, what would you do? So we talked with them for several months, and we said, well, you would need to first change the culture in the classroom and change the instructional process to a cooperative process. That would be part one. And then you would have to ensure that students who were beginning to fall behind had extra time so that they could take advantage of what was going on in the classroom. So we set up tutoring structures to ensure that students were successful. We chose reading as the core, learning to read. We were starting with elementary schools. We decided that reading was the critical thing. If students can't read, then they're not going to be successful in school. So getting kids to be successful at learning to read was the goal, was the most concrete goal that we took on. We knew that for kids to be successful, they would need to be in school every day. In Baltimore, that wasn't something that was common. In elementary school, at that time, the attendance rate for first graders, you know, that's when it's the highest, was 80%. 80% of first graders were getting to school every day. That's not enough. So we put in plans to ensure that students were in school and that they were in school on time, and that when they got to school, they weren't hungry, and that they had had adequate sleep. So we had to engage their parents in making sure that they were supporting their children. And sometimes that was solving the social problems that the parents had, and other times it was simply making sure that the parents weren't afraid of the school and could partner with the school. And sometimes it was teaching parents how to just celebrate with their children what they had learned in the evening. So we developed a fairly complex program that we called Success for All. And we started in a school in Baltimore. This turned out not to be just an academic discussion, but something the school district wanted to do. So in 1987, we began with one school. And at the same time, we had a second school that was very similar. So we had two very similar schools. And we used these tools that we had talked about in this first school. And in 1 year, we had students who had gained a year and 4 months worth of learning. And this was in a school that was failing. So with the additional resources, with all of the structures, we were able to make substantial gains in a short time. We continued this project and expanded to new schools over the next 5 years. And we took a look at these kids who had been using this program for 5 years. And we found that the assignments of students to special education identification were reduced by more than half. And the number of students required to repeat a grade, which is what you do if you utterly fail, was cut by two-thirds. And we found that on the assessments that the schools typically gave to measure their own progress, that the schools made, I don't know, do effect sizes make sense to you? 3/4 of a standard deviation of difference? It was a big effect. It was significant. It was educationally meaningful. These children were a full year ahead of the children who were in the comparable school by this time. That year was enough to make the difference between staying in school and dropping out of school. It gave children the sense that they could be successful. And the students who had been in our pilot school stayed in school, and we measured by eighth grade the dropout rate, which had already begun to, by eighth grade in Baltimore, students were beginning to drop out. Our students had not dropped out. So there's incredible power in doing what we can using the research for children. If our schools aren't using the research that we have and is available, then we're not giving our children what they deserve. And so that's why I so much appreciate The invitation that we've had this week to talk with you all about cooperative learning and about research, and I'll be delighted to take questions.